Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
In 1998, Suzanne Richardson, a Texas A&M student at their Galveston campus, heads to work as a night clerk at a hotel and condo complex. She expects to study overnight and leave at 7 a.m. At 6 a.m., the security guard checks on her before he heads out. But by 6:15 a.m., as a couple heads to check out, Suzanne is no longer at her desk. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Sonia Ball.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
Vanessa, I have news.
You do?
But I don't know if it's new news, like current news, or at this point, old news?
Wait, what? News to me that would be current and or old, or news to our listeners?
Our listeners, because I think one of the things that's not necessarily apparent about our process is that we record these episodes, but we also don't always know when we're going to release them.
Right.
Because we're waiting on our celebrity guests who are amazing and we appreciate them so much, but we're waiting for them to fit us into their schedule. And so sometimes we're waiting. And so I don't know where in the system this episode is going to be.
Okay.
So is it current news? Is it old news? I don't know, but I started a newsletter.
Oh, yes, I knew this news.
You did, yes.
I know this news.
Even though you haven't subscribed yet.
I tried.
You did?
I did. I tried.
Okay.
There was a complication.
There was a complication with remembering your email address?
No, I got the email address in.
Okay.
And then I hit everything else, and then it brought me somewhere else.
Well, that's not cool.
Right. So I wanted to retry it, but on my computer because I was doing it on my phone.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what happened. And then, you know how I am. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that. And then I was like, oh, I need to retry that on my computer. And then I got distracted.
You didn't make it back.
And I never made it back.
So the newsletter, Vanessa will get on board eventually. But the newsletter is called Girl Hunt, and it's on Substack. And you can reach it through girlhuntmedia.com.
Right. I did. I read it.
Did you?
Yay. So, I mean, I did the thing, part of a thing. I just need to finish subscribing.
Finish it. And one of the reasons that I'm bringing it up here is that there are times when we're talking during our episode that I'm like, oh, I really want to investigate this topic more, or I want to write something longer about it, or I have found some random true crime thing. And it just doesn't fit with the scope of what we're talking about in the episode.
Right.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm just going to create a space for myself for that. So hopefully.
So random tidbits or like extra information or side notes or what kind of things are we going to have like more of those side stories? Like remember the dogs with the cyanide?
Yes. The dogs with the cyanide from our Dorothy.
Yes.
Arnold episode. So that would be a perfect place
right.
for me to expand more into. Or, you know, we were talking about like amnesia and
yes.
why that was so popular as like a diagnosis for missing persons.
Mm-hmm.
So something like that. Or I come across an article that's like, woman attacked by deer.
I was about to say the deer.
Yes.
Yes, because that woman's like a champion of sorts.
Right.
Yes.
So that would be a place to explore that more, or just about the true crime genre, books, to promote like other creators in that space. So it's kind of a variety of things.
But a potpourri.
A potpourri, yes.
A little hodgepodge.
Mm-hmm. But it is out there in the world, and the name is inspired by Ruth Baumgartner, who, as I was researching her, there was an article that said Girl Hunt.
Oh, a headline for her disappearance?
Yeah.
Girl Hunt.
Girl Hunt. And I was like, that is a particularly great name, because I think what the ultimately what it's about is locating women in the true crime genre. So
right. And to just clarify for anyone trying to look that up, right? Because can they find that?
Yeah.
It's one word.
Girl Hunt is one word, yes. Yes. Not hyphenated
or two words. Like girl and hunt.
Right.
Girl Hunt.
Girl Hunt.
Manhunt is one word too.
Yeah.
All the hunts. Wait, but like deer hunt?
I think that's two.
Yeah.
Right?
Fox hunting is two.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Mm. Hmm. But when it's human, it's one. Both man and girl.
Well, technically,
is there any woman hunt?
Was hyphenated. Girl hyphen hunt.
So you unhyphenated.
I unhyphenated.
You one worded it. But okay. Manhunt is one word, so it's only fair. We get what they get.
Right. So you can find me on Substack, and we'll put links in various places so that you can find that if you're interested.
Have we shared it on our own socials yet?
We haven't.
Okay, let's do that.
Recording this.
Okay, so you might have already
encountered
that as future people.
Uh-huh. Where are we in the timeline?
We don't know. There is actually no poem written yet for this one.
There is not.
So this is how new this one is.
Yes, but the poem is on its way.
You don't even know what the poem is going to be.
Well, I do have some ideas of what the poem is going to be.
Do you have an idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's there. It's just not out.
There are words floating in my head. There are words. But it is not written. Yeah. I mean, it's just interesting because I don't think that, like, we're kind of unveiling a bit of our process here.
Well, yeah, and we also do the poem talks over on the Behind the Poem for our Patreon listeners.
Yes.
So we never really talk about the poem stuff here very much.
Right.
Your process would be over there if they want to find that. But I think it's just fun that we're doing this and you don't even have a poem yet. And and you do, though, know. Like, I dabble a little bit in poetry, and half the time I don't know what I'm doing. It's just like blurp.
It just appears on the
page. Yeah, I think I'm writing something and then it comes out differently.
No, so like as I'm making these episodes, I'm also thinking about words and terms and phrases and images that might go into the poem. So, yes, the poem, as of our recording this, does not exist, but our listeners won't know because by the time they hear it, it will have already been recorded.
So hopefully by then, yes, the poem will be done. The poem will be recorded, obviously, and hopefully they already know about Girl Hunt.
Exactly.
And this is old news.
And it will be old news.
Yes. Yes. Or a refresher.
Or we have new listeners who are like, I don't even know what I'm listening to.
Like, who are these people and why won't they shut up?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to dive into the actual episode.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so for today's episode, we are going back to the Texas killing fields.
Yikes.
Yes. So earlier this year, I said that I was making a commitment to cover some of the stories from this area of Texas. And honestly, it became so heartbreaking that I just needed to hit pause on it for a little bit. Okay. So we have a few episodes about the Texas killing field. So I'm going to do some recap. So if you've been listening to us for a while, you've heard this before, but it's a good reminder. So to recap, the Texas Killing Fields was initially a name given to a small 25-acre piece of land off of Calder Road in League City, Texas. This is where the bodies of four women who were homicide victims were found in the 1980s through early 1990s. Two of these women, Audrey Lee Cook and Donna Prudhomme, were unidentified for nearly 30 years, but we talked about them and how they were identified in episode 22. Since then, the name Texas Killing Fields has become more expansive. Generally now, it's considered the area of Texas that extends south of Houston to Galveston, largely on the I-45 corridor. And the reason for this expansion of this term in this area is because this part of Texas has become known for a large number of unsolved murders and disappearances, primarily, but not exclusively, of women.
Do we have any kind of like rough numbers on
it's a lot.
What a lot is?
Yeah. I mean, there was a series of 11 murders in Galveston. There's
so like more than 20?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Some of them we don't talk about here because we focus on missing and unidentified women, right? So to cover the missing area or missing women in this area, we did talk about a woman named Shelley Sykes in episode 26. She was a 19-year-old college student. She'd been working on Memorial Day weekend at Guido's, a well-known historic restaurant in Galveston. She left work to head to her boyfriend's house, but later her car was found abandoned on the side of a frontage road near I-45. Her kidnappers and killers were later found, but failed to reveal the location of her body, and we're going to refer a bit to Shelley's story in this episode, which is why I'm giving a little bit more information there.
Okay.
Additionally, we cover the story of Tot Tran Harriman.
Tot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who was visiting her family in Texas in 2001 when she disappeared on a trip to go house hunting. I guess she wasn't even house hunting. It was like region hunting to see where she might want to move. And you can find her story in episode 31. And I just like...
If you haven't listened to that one, that would be a good one to go back to, like, if you're new to us, because she just has such a rich history going up to her disappearance. Mm-hmm. So it's just a very... She had, like, a very eventful but, like, nice life in a way.
Like, it's like, a complicated... She was there for, like, so many historic moments in time.
And just super positive, a little ray of sunshine.
Yeah. Okay, so despite this coverage that we have done, there are more missing women in this region of Texas, and today our focus is on one of them, Suzanne Renee Richardson. And I am saying Richardson, not Richardson.
No D.
And she went missing from Galveston in 1988.
And you're clarifying on that because we really wanted a D in there.
I keep on adding it in because I know a writer, Suzanne Richardson.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, wow, they have the same name. And then I was like, no, they don't have the same name, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so when I am researching the women whose stories we're telling here, I don't just focus on what happened to them. That's just part of their story. So I should clarify that Suzanne's family and friends often refer to her by her middle name, which is Renee.
Okay.
And I don't know if this was her preference in life, but sometimes I have to make a decision of how we refer to someone in our episodes. Because I want to both, like, balance the respect of their name preferences, but also make clear that in telling these stories, like, I don't necessarily have the right to call them by their nickname.
Mm-hmm.
So since the papers largely used Suzanne, I'm going to use that name. You will hear me say Renee, though, when it's a direct quote.
So for listeners, Renee and Suzanne are in fact the same person.
Yes. Okay. Now, the first mention I can find of Suzanne is in 1973 in a paper when that December, an 8-year-old Suzanne wrote to Santa, and it was published in the Deer Park Progress paper. She wrote, "Dear Santa, I love you very, very much. I made a deer. I believe in you. I have been good, too."
And is this the spelling of it?
Yeah, so bin is B-I-N, and the two is T-O.
That's incredibly sweet.
Yes. Apparently, long after this moment, Christmas was her favorite holiday of the year. So, you know, later when she goes missing, her dad will tell reporters that he knew this happened, that people went missing. He just never thought it would happen to his family. And we know now... So we're looking at this from, you know, his future, that it does happen to Suzanne. So when I look back at, like, an 8-year-old writing to, like, Santa, like, it's honestly, that's, like, one of the things that devastates me the most, right?
Right. And not only an 8-year-old writing to Santa, but you know she's loved because, like, there's a parent or somebody helping her.
Right.
Do this.
Get her letter to Santa. Yeah. And she really is... loved. Her family home is near Killeen, Texas, which we actually talked about in a different episode for Deanne Merrifield. And she has a younger brother who is just a few years younger than her and a younger sister who's 2 years younger than him. So she is the oldest. Her mom works as a branch manager for Capital City Savings in Killeen, and her dad works at an engineering firm in Houston. In 1984, Suzanne graduated from Florence High School and decides to go away to college to attend Galveston branch of Texas A&M. She studies marine transportation there, which is really how you know you're at a coastal university, that there's an option of studying marine transportation.
What is marine transportation?
Okay, so like think about like when, because we live close to the Canadian border, right? Yeah. So we deal like, so think about like the brokers and stuff like that who are actually like helping people cross the border right. with goods and services, right?
Okay, so she's actually helping marine situations?
Yes. Yeah, so it would be like incoming boats and things. But her ultimate goal is not marine transportation. She actually wants to graduate.
Okay.
And then go on to study maritime law. So, and become a lawyer in the field.
Okay.
Of maritime law,
which is different than regular law.
So a niche
part of law.
Yes. Law study. Okay. So she is active on campus and was part of the Student Association of the Maritime Administrators. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not alone in these studies.
No.
But she was really also busy off campus. Donna Kalenius, who was a spokesperson for the university, knew Suzanne personally and said, Renee, again, that's her name that she goes by. Renee is a pretty amazing person. She's about the only person I know who could carry a full course load, work all night long, and come to school with a smile on her face.
You know, one of the things we talk about a lot, my favorite part of all of these episodes, of course, is listening about the girls before, just like their story. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are like real go-getters.
Yes.
These are highly motivated, strong women. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, I think a lot of the time when people talk about missing women or missing girls, they think of them as like naive or weaklings or like girls that are out like in the wrong places.
Right.
No.
No.
That's not the experience I'm having listening to your stories week after week.
Yeah. So, you know, I think as well, it's because in any situation, or often what happens in situations in which something bad has happened to a woman, like victim blaming mm-hmm. starts to happen, right? And yeah, so she is like, she's a college student. She's got plans. She's working really hard.
She's a happy girl. She's got yes. everything going for her.
Right. Yeah. And so Donna specifically, who's the spokesperson who knows her, is specifically saying that this about Suzanne's work experience, because by this point, Suzanne is a senior and she is not only working hard to graduate and looking forward to getting into law school, but she's working two jobs as well.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So she's living on Ball Street in an apartment in one of the Victorian houses with her brother, who at the time was a freshman, and the two of them worked as wait staff at Guido's in Galveston. Suzanne worked in the chart room, which my understanding of Guido's history is this was originally a coffee shop.
Weren't we just talking about Guido's?
We were, because that's where Shelley Sykes was working when she went missing 2 years previously.
Oh.
Shelley had actually left work at Guido's and was on the way to her boyfriend's when she went missing.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is why calling attention to this particular area is important to me, because, like, there's a greater ecosystem here, right? In addition, on September 16th, 1988, Suzanne started working as a night auditor at Casa del Mar. This was kind of a combo hotel condo complex that was apparently considered pretty posh. Those are not my words. That's the words that were.
Okay.
I don't often say posh.
I haven't heard you say it.
No. Basically, Suzanne would be working the desk from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. in case any guests needed anything or were checking out. Suzanne had done this type of work 2 years before at the flagship hotel, and she really liked it because she could actually get a lot of studying done while at work. I actually know a lot of writers who have worked desk jobs like that before.
Just have time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're getting paid, but they can also get some writing done. So because Suzanne was so busy, a lot of people on the 700-person Galveston campus knew her as hardworking and well-liked, but weren't particularly close with her. Her friend Mark, who had known her for the 3 years she'd been in college, said she was shy but really friendly if you got to know her. On Thursday, October 6th, 1988, Mark says he saw her around 7 p.m. They'd been talking about an upcoming test they had to take together when she left to go find her brother. He said everything seemed fine, except she seemed a bit anxious about finding her brother. Her brother said he actually last saw her around 6 p.m. that night, so I'm not actually sure the two connected before she headed to work at Casa del Mar. It sounds like Suzanne had a pretty typical night at work. Casa del Mar had a hired private security guard who was on the premises until 6 a.m., but Suzanne's shift went until 7 a.m. He says that when he punched out, he checked on Suzanne at the front desk and she was sitting there and appeared to be, in his words, in good health. At 6:15 a.m., a couple who were checking out came to the lobby and said that they didn't see anyone there, so they dropped their room key on the desk and left. At 6:40 to 6:45 a.m., the day clerk came in for their shift, and that shift started at 7, and was startled to find Suzanne wasn't there.
Okay, so she was there at 6, but not there at 6:15?
Yes.
Okay.
And then the day shift person comes in at 6:40. 6:45.
And she's still not there.
We'll be back in a moment.
Her manager would later say that Suzanne was an excellent employee who was kind and considerate, so I'm guessing the day clerk also realized this, even though Suzanne had only worked there for, what, 2 or 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Because the alarm is sounded immediately, like, Suzanne should be there. She's not. She's not someone who would have left her post. The police arrive on the scene to find Suzanne is missing, but not many other clues. Like, her purse is still there. Her school books are there as well. There's money in the cash register, so obviously this is not, like, a robbery situation. Later, a maintenance man finds a single brown leather shoe in the parking lot, and it's believed to be Suzanne's. But other than some scuff marks on the desk and on the employee entrance door, it seems like she has just vanished.
Were they ever able to prove that the shoe was hers? Or?
So my guess is that it is, but all the newspaper reports of the time are very vague about it. And unfortunately, the report that we got from Galveston did not illuminate this at all.
So never been clarified.
Right. So an immediate search for Suzanne is launched. One of the early reports of something amiss comes from some guests and a resident at Casa del Mar. It's unclear in the reporting whether this is the same person or two different people, to be clear. So one said he heard a scream but went back to sleep when he didn't hear anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe a different one said they heard a woman screaming, which prompted them to look down the hall, but the screaming stopped and then they heard a door shut.
Okay. And so this is all in one of the rooms, or where is this that they're hearing this?
So they heard it from their residence, because it's like a condo slash hotel.
Okay, so they heard it from their unit at the same building?
Yeah.
But they don't know which place the screams are coming from, is what I'm saying, or the door. Which door is being slammed? They don't know anything about that.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay. So the initial search of the grounds feels to me extensive, right? So the car Suzanne had borrowed to get to work was still in the parking lot. And while there is some questions about whether or not she disappeared on her own volition at the beginning, it's mostly assumed that she was taken from work by force.
It seems weird to just leave partway through a shift too. Like,
yeah.
Not like you only have an hour left.
Right.
Get to the end of your hour and then.
Yeah. So like it doesn't match up with who she was. Doesn't make sense. Now, later in the day, the Texas Department of Corrections officers sends 40 volunteers to search through the nearby fields. There's talk about getting some bloodhounds to search for her, but the dogs are in on a case in Amarillo, so that's a 12-hour drive away, they say.
Mm.
And so they didn't think that the dogs would get there in time to be of any use. Police end up visiting all the complexes, 276 rooms, looking for her, but turn up no leads. Detective Captain Ernest Galvin says that at this point in the investigation that they have no clues, no suspects, no motive. Now, the search does continue through the weekend, but by Monday, Lieutenant Rick Boyle of the Galveston Police Department reports that nothing has panned out so far. Now, the search efforts for Suzanne are pretty robust, at least in comparison to some of the other cases that we've talked about. I mean, there are definite failings here, but Texas A&M, Suzanne's university, they host a press conference on that Tuesday, and about 200 students are there, and they pick up 1,000 posters to distribute The university promises more in the next few days once they're printed. In addition, a reward fund is started pretty quickly, and by Wednesday, it's up to $15,000. Part of the money comes from students, part from local residents, and some from the owners of the complex, Casa del Mar. The Galveston Police Department, they also have administered a polygraph test to the security guard, but he passes, as does a woman who had reportedly seen Suzanne in the office that night. And in this week, there is a task force established that consisted of FBI agents, the district attorney's office, sheriff's deputies, and local police. Galveston police places a detective on the case named Harry Millo. This is his sole case, so he's not working on anything else.
So they are taking it quite seriously compared to a lot of things we've talked about in the past.
Yes, so it's very apparent that something has happened. So despite all these efforts, no substantial leads come in for Suzanne. Her parents wait by the phone in Suzanne's apartment, hopeful she will call or the news will come, like something will happen, right? Because there's so little to go on, and because of the potential missing shoe, the scuff marks, everyone realizes pretty early that it's likely Suzanne is not alive. Just 4 days after her disappearance, her grandmother says, "We hope they find her. So much time has gone by, you just don't know." One of the campus secretaries kind of echoes this in her public statement. She says, "I think it's pretty much the university-wide feeling that something horrible has happened to her. Everybody seems to be thinking about Shelley Sykes." Now, she's not the only one who draws a comparison between Suzanne and Shelley. They both worked at the same restaurant. They were close in age. People had heard Suzanne scream, while others had actually witnessed Shelley being abducted. So there's all these, like, comparisons here. At the time Suzanne goes missing, though, Shelley's family had found out some information about their daughter's disappearance. So as a quick recap, she'd been kidnapped by two men. They'd spotted Shelley as she left work that night and followed her before running her off the road. They killed Shelley and buried her. And a year later, one of the men confessed to the crime and implicated his friend. So that has all happened before Suzanne goes missing.
Somewhat solved, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So throughout those early days and weeks of Suzanne's disappearance, Shelley's family, particularly her stepmother, were a support system for the Richardsons. She accompanies them, for instance, to a vigil held on campus 1 month after Suzanne disappeared, and Shelley's stepmother, Denise, spoke at the vigil.
I'm sure this is opening up all those wounds again that Shelley's family has been really trying to heal.
Yeah, you know, at this point in Shelley's sort of chronology, you know, her family had found out a lot of what had happened to her, but they still hadn't located her.
Right.
Yeah. So the weeks are kind of wearing on here, and by December, Suzanne's mom, Kathy, said that she had gone through a phase where she couldn't stand to have anyone around her. She couldn't read or sleep or eat, and that the rest of the family had been going through something similar. Now, December also brings one of the few major leads in Suzanne's case. So these details are not released until many years later, right? You just get to know them here, kind of in this chronological order, okay? So basically what happens is an unknown man called one of Suzanne's friends, okay? Through a series of 6 phone calls on December 5th of the year Suzanne goes missing, this man revealed that he had been with 2 other men in the early morning hours on October 7th. He claims that he was their driver that night.
Okay.
So the friend doesn't know who this man is.
So he calls after the disappearance and says, "This is what happened on October 7th.
Yes. He says the men, whose names might have been Johnny and Barry, or he might have said Jerry, kidnapped Suzanne. He claims these men were ex-cons who worked in the oil industry and that they took Suzanne to a field outside Galveston off of Route 2004 and that they killed Suzanne and buried her body in this field. Apparently, the caller was crying on the phone when he revealed this information.
And he was the driver?
Yes.
Okay.
So he was a witness to what happened.
Okay.
Now, at the time, the public does not know this information. Okay, by January, they only reveal that a 20-person task force had searched an area about 15 miles south of Hitchcock along Texas Highway 2004, and they had dug in some areas. They didn't find anything. They also revealed that they had a caller. They didn't say who the caller was calling, just that there had been a caller, and that they were hoping the caller would call back because this person had been vague in their instructions of location. And they were hoping this caller would call back and give them more details about the location.
Okay. So it's the same caller that they're referring to.
Yes.
Okay.
So this call doesn't come in. Like, the caller doesn't, the man doesn't call back. Okay. So much of the information, though, about the men's names was revealed by a private investigator by the name of Willie Payne. Payne was hired by Suzanne's family, and he believed that by going on things like local radio stations and talking about these developments, it would aid in the discovery of new information. This was in conflict, though, to what others wanted in this case. So you've got the private investigator who's like, let's get out there, let's say what we're going to say. On the other hand, the FBI, they were hesitant to release this information because they felt it placed their informant at risk. Right. So if you're out there saying a man called in and revealed some information,
then the informant's at risk.
Yeah. And Milo, who had been assigned by Galveston to the case, was worried that it would cause unnecessary suspicion of anyone named Johnny, Jerry, or Barry. Right.
Which there's probably a lot of.
Yes.
People with that name. So, yes.
Yeah. So they're at odds with one another. You know, meanwhile, though, Suzanne's family, they're pushing forward with what they can do. They worked on flyer distribution, getting her photo on the backs of tractor trailers, taking out billboards. Like, this had actually worked in Shelley Sykes' case. Shelley's killer had actually seen her flyer at a bar just south of the Mexican border, and he was essentially racked with guilt, and this ultimately leads to him being apprehended. So there's likely, like, a lot of hope that this kind of case as well. At the same time, the private investigator, Payne, also continued his work. He had a lead on a backyard of a house in Lamarck, Texas. Apparently, one of his key suspects had rented the home, and this person moved out in October or November of 1988, so kind of around the time Suzanne went missing. Mm-hmm. Now, someone had reported that the backyard looked to have a depression. But when Payne searched there, it was clear it wasn't a dig site because the tree roots had not been disturbed or cut like you would see if someone had been digging there.
So it was just a natural depression.
Yeah. Now, in 1990, another tip was finally revealed to the public. This was that some farmers in Brazoria County claimed to witness three men digging in the same area where investigators had searched before off of Texas Highway 2004.
And that checks out with the caller, right?
Yes.
There would have been three men.
Yep. This area had been searched multiple times by law enforcement and by the private investigator, Payne. Now, by this point, Payne was really working Suzanne's case independently, vowing not to give up searching for her. At one point, he brought in cadaver dogs who alerted on the site, so he took some soil samples. These were inconclusive. The samples seemed to test positive for a type of bacteria that would be present when there are human remains. But the lab cautioned these results could be skewed because this is a cattle pasture and basically the urine and feces from the cows would impact the results. It was through Payne, though, that the Cleveland Construction Company volunteered to use their equipment to dig in this area in 1990. Initially, Suzanne's parents, who had since moved closer to Galveston to be more accessible, didn't want to be there, but they changed their minds. Her mom said of Suzanne's father, "I wasn't going to let him come by himself. He said he couldn't stand to sit through the weekend and not know if she was here. He wanted to be here when they found her. It's been such a long time." Despite everyone's hopes, they did not find Suzanne during that search. Now, in 1998, this area is searched again. This time, divers are taking to the waters in Cloud Bayou, which is near Texas Highway 2004. Now, there had been another anonymous call, this one stating that Suzanne's torso had been left in the bayou. This search was now 10 years after Suzanne went missing, and in that time there'd been significant weather events and animal activity. But we do know in a stream bed, they found a group of bone fragments in the silt. Most, though, were determined to be animal.
Most?
Yeah, so...
how does that work?
So some of them, at this point, they're like fragments that have been there for quite a while.
Okay.
So the ones that they were able to identify did check out to be animal. At the time, some were deemed to be inconclusive. Looking at the Galveston report that we did get, though, it does list in evidence a box of bones, but they are labeled animal bones.
Okay.
Or I should say they're labeled non-human bones.
Which can only mean...
right. Like, what kind of bones are they?
Right.
Yeah. So this kind of sits for a while, and it's very clear that some stuff is going on behind the scenes, but it's not being publicly reported. So when it does get reported, we're in the late 1990s into the early 2000s, a lot has shifted in Suzanne's case. In that time, the police had cited three possible suspects, one of whom at the time had died from a drug overdose, and the other two were cousins. I believe actually one of the cousins has also now since died as well. But it's believed that these three are linked to those anonymous calls in 1988. Now, in the intervening years since Suzanne went missing, numerous relatives and friends have come forward, basically relatives and friends of the cousins have come forward saying they believe these cousins were responsible for Suzanne's kidnapping and death, and that these men had said as much themselves, telling some people that they had dismembered her. And so you can see kind of the pieces are starting to come together. One man who makes these calls back in 1988, who confesses that he was there with two other men. Farmers who report seeing three men in a field. The repeated visits to locations along Texas Highway 2004. Like, the picture of what was done starts to come into focus. Now, some of these informants recall seeing one of the men removing carpet from his van shortly after Suzanne disappeared. And then this man admitted that a murder took place in the van. Now, from these informants, the story seems to be that Suzanne encountered one of these men at a party or out somewhere. We know that Suzanne didn't socialize a lot because of her schedule, but we do know that she attended a local tavern where she ordered a mixed drink called Planter's Punch that had low alcohol content, and she was there pretty frequently. It's also entirely likely that she, like many other returning college students, attended some events as everyone got back to Galveston at the start of the academic year. So apparently this man met her there and had been following her since. Like, he became obsessed with
her. So he's a stalker at this point. Like, he's a full-out stalker. Does he go to her college?
It does not sound like this man went to her college. It sounds like the man kind of lived and worked in the area.
So he's a local, but not a student.
Yeah, it does not sound like he's a student. I mean, I could be wrong because I'm trying to, like, read between the lines of what has been publicly revealed.
Stalking situations are always really scary.
Yes.
It just seems like a time bomb waiting to happen, right? When that starts to...
right. So if you imagine she's working at nights by herself.
Had she ever told anybody that she's being stalked? Does she know she's being stalked?
It's unclear. So her father says he did not know of this situation. That he has, you know, obviously learned a lot since, but...
okay. So she didn't tell him, at least.
No. And honestly, this isn't something that's in the papers prior to the, like, early 2000s. So my guess is she probably didn't know.
Okay.
Because, like, if she had this suspicion of being stalked and told someone, that would have been, like, in the early information, right?
Right. That's, yeah. That's even more disturbing, I guess, yeah. To be just quietly stalked.
Yeah.
You, like, can't do anything about it. What can you do about that?
So she, it doesn't sound like she had any awareness. Now, yeah. So, like I said, her father didn't know. And that, again, that could be something she kept to herself. But also, according to the informants, this man the rationale this man gives for what happens is that he apparently became enraged when he saw Suzanne hugging or interacting with the private security guard at the hotel the morning she disappeared.
So he's like jealous of this interaction?
It sounds like it, but there's some extra ick to this, which is the private security guard was Black.
Okay.
So this could have been racially motivated, that he was upset that she was interacting specifically with a man, but a Black man.
He's rationalizing killing somebody because she has a Black friend that she hugged?
Yeah, so apparently, according to the informants, this fits with this man, what they know of this man.
That's absolutely awful. I don't even know the rage like the parents would feel for something like this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because again, you know, what we always end up hearing is like this, the rationalization of the surviving member of this interaction who happens to be her killer. Right. Yeah. So we get to hear he has rationalized it in this way.
No, I think I've read some more of that. Like, obviously, people that are stalking someone put them on, like, this pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if this hug was just enough to, like, completely change everything for him.
Right. I mean, like, if he's been stalking her and somehow believes that she in some way is his
mm-hmm.
in a possession sort of way. Right.
That's awful.
Yeah. Now, despite all this information, the DA never brought this case before a grand jury. There's a lot of division about this because some people feel like there is enough information to move forward with a case. There's some people who believe there's not. And the DA, who's responsible for it, said, you know, there's just not enough evidence here to make a solid case to go forward. Now, when this information came to light in 2001, Suzanne's family was waiting for this to happen, for it to move to a grand jury. It's now been 23 more years, and it hasn't. And if this story is true, if this man or men, three men are responsible, the main suspect in this case chose to abduct and kill Suzanne on his own 24th birthday.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Cloud Bayou Lament, read by Sonia Ball. A born performer and one of Canada's voiceover elite, Sonia has over 30 years' experience and is well known for her tremendous versatility in commercials, animation, narration, documentaries, audiobooks, video games, talking toys, and more. Sonia has been nominated for ACTRA's Best Voiceover Performance Award and has voiced principal roles in a host of award-winning animation series and films including Arthur, Whimsy's House, Madeline's Christmas, Pinocchio 3000, Snowtime, Spookly and the Christmas Kittens, and many more. She has voiced everything from gaming characters for Ubisoft to ads for well-recognized companies such as Lancôme and Vaseline. She brings her broad base of experience into play as a voiceover coach for up-and-coming young actors. Sonia is also a Montreal music scene veteran and singer-songwriter, singing the number 10 Billboard dance hit and number 1 England dance chart hit, Can't Live Without You, in 1986 as Susie Q. Over the years, she has performed in top venues throughout North America, singing in several band scenarios opening for legends like Smokey Robinson, Glenn Campbell, and Charlie Bird. She has recorded theme songs and music CDs related to the animation productions she has voiced and continues to write and co-produce her own music.
Cloud Bayou Lament, Susan Richardson, 22, missing since October 8, 1988, from Galveston, Texas. In the loam and silt of the bayou, the slender ladyfish flashes like silver coins in the sun-flooded water, while the woman puts the sea on her back, wraps herself in tentacles of salt. Here, oil spreads in rainbows across the plains of her skin, her breath buoying her lungs. You can't drown what never lived. Out here in the islands, those wrecks always seem to be men, as though hidden beneath the water. Sometimes I think of the bombs in the Thames, how at any moment they could detonate and the people upriver couldn't prepare, though the bombs were always there, waiting to explode. And over here we rest along the bayou's edge and watch the clouds chasing across the surface.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better. With new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect, the fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.